and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers. Coming up on The Wire today...
potential game changer. It would have not only security but economic consequences for the region.
China has announced that in addition to generous aid, it will be negotiating to build a naval base in Vanuatu in Australia's backyard. This provocative step ramps up concerns about China's ambitions to control world trade following its island building in the South China Sea trade route and the One Belt, One Road initiative. Also today on The Wire...
who actually is holding all your genetic information now and for what purposes and in what way might it be used in the future? I think that people should be careful about handing over information that's particular to them that has the potential to prejudice their whole life in some way down the track.
With many people finding out about their family tree through websites like Ancestry, when you send in for a DNA test, just what happens to that genetic information? Who could access it? Reports are starting to emerge that insurance companies want the DNA info to add to their informational arsenal. And what if police and other government agencies get access? We find out. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. But first... Aboriginal people are overrepresented in Australia's prison systems, with numbers increasing in recent years. An Australian Law Reform Commission report released last week suggests reasons for disparities and potential solutions. Caitlin McHugh asked Elise Methvin just how bad this problem is.
Yeah, so there is a huge disproportionate rate of imprisonment. So, for example, amongst the general population, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders represent 27% of the national prison population, but approximately 3% of the national population. And that's really significant, for example, in states like the Northern Territory, where Indigenous people represent 30% of the general population, but approximately 80% of the prison population.
Not only are Aboriginal people overrepresented in prisons, they're far more likely to suffer mental disorders, according to Brett Collins, a coordinator for Justice Action, a prisoner advocacy group.
You know, the 73% of male prisoners are regarded as having a mental disorder, 86% of females are having a mental disorder, and the rate of people who are inside prison, there are 17 times the rate of psychotic disorders suffered by male detainees, 50 times of the level of psychotic disorders by Aboriginal people inside the prison. So now these are just enormous figures that show that prisons, in fact, have become de facto psychiatric hospitals where people are isolated at an enormous social cost and economic cost, amazing cost.
Damien Griffiths is the CEO of First Persons Disability Network and co-chair of the Change the Record campaign, which lobbies for changes to the Australian justice system.
The reason why we have such a dramatic increase in the rates of incarceration of Aboriginal people is for a range of reasons, and that includes things like institutional racism, frankly, and also the increasing criminalisation of disability, which we see as a major issue that requires some urgent attention. It's an issue that's been overlooked for far too long. So we've seen over the years growing evidence of a dramatic increase in the number of Aboriginal people with a range of different disability types who are being placed in prison, often when they shouldn't be there in the first place. And these can be people that have a range of cognitive impairments. They may have intellectual disability, they may have acquired brain injury, they may be people living with mental illness, they may be people with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, for example. And often what happens, particularly in regional remote Australia, you generally get very little support around your disability. So often what happens is the only interactions that some people have might be with the police. And people end up often in the back of paddy wagons, and really what they need is meaningful support around their disability.
In addition to a lack of support for Aboriginal people with mental disabilities, fines for relatively minor offences can pile up, leading to more serious consequences, says Dr. Elise Methvin of University of Technology Sydney.
Someone can get a community service order, and if they fail to comply with that community service order, or are for some reason ineligible for a community service order in some states, that can lead to imprisonment. And basically that means that some people serve a certain number of days in prison in lieu of an amount of unpaid fines.
There's also evidence the judicial system is harsher on Aboriginal defendants.
But there have been studies to demonstrate that when Indigenous people are receiving a sentence, they're actually more likely than non-Indigenous people to receive a prison sentence. So Indigenous people are generally sentenced more harshly than non-Indigenous people. But also there are there's a greater likelihood of Indigenous people having a criminal record, sometimes for quite low-level offending as well. And with that criminal record, that might mean that they are more likely to receive a prison sentence.
Advocates like Damien Griffiths are calling for more to be done, both when mentally ill Aboriginal people come
what
into contact with police and
before. A national investment in the custody notification service that's been operating in some parts of New South Wales with some success. And what that would do is alert disability advocates that there is an Aboriginal person with disability who's, you know, perhaps been taken into custody or is about to participate in a police interview, and then a disability advocate's provided to provide support to that. And one of the other things that we see really problematic is a lack of early intervention supports, a lack of meaningful disability supports for many of our people with disability, which is then resulting in this trajectory that sees some Aboriginal people with disability ending up in prison when they just frankly shouldn't be there.
Damien Griffiths, CEO of First Persons Disability Network, ending that report by Caitlin McHugh. Carefully, do you read terms and conditions? What if, without realising, you gave police and insurance providers complete access to your genetic information? When you've got a saliva sample, when you give a saliva sample to online genealogy services like Ancestry.com and 23andMe, as well as finding a surprise cousin in Iceland, you might find you're at an increased risk of certain diseases. This information could fall into the hands of insurance companies. Caroline Wagner reports.
Jane Tiller, Ethical, Legal and Social Advisor in Public Health Genomics at Monash University, is concerned that people don't realise how much data their genetic information holds.
At this stage, the companies that we know about are more research-type companies. So we know pharmaceutical companies are very interested in accessing large data sets and large biobanks of information for their kind of pharmaceutical research. And other research companies are also very interested in having large amounts of DNA data to do testing and research on. And this is something that in some ways might be quite positive. A lot of people might like to know that their data is being used to further research, and people like that idea sometimes. But it's more about understanding who can get access to that information and whether you are comfortable with it. At this stage, we're not aware of what other kinds of data mining companies might want to purchase this information, but it's something to keep in mind. And with the social media, the Facebook things that have happened in the past few weeks, we understand that access to data and information is big dollars, and it may be that in the future getting access to genetic data is something that also companies start looking at.
Genetic testing also has implications on your insurance, and customers don't realise what they're signing up for when they use genealogy services. Several services declare in their privacy statements that they will not share your genetic information with any third parties, including employers, insurance companies and marketers, without your explicit consent. But that doesn't stop life insurance providers asking you if you've undergone genetic testing and what the results were. Ms. Tiller again.
People having testing need to be aware that if there is information that comes out of that testing, even if it's not the purpose for which they had the test, if that information does show increased risk in a health context, it may be something that an insurer and require you to disclose, and they then use. The life insurance company won't be able to get the data directly from 23andMe, for example. However, you're required by law to disclose any relevant information to an insurer when you make that application. Most life insurers now, when you make an application, will ask you if you've had genetic testing, and if you say yes, you're required to disclose that under the the duty of disclosure under our insurance laws. Now, this doesn't affect health insurance. In Australia, health insurance is specifically protected by legislation, and so health insurers can't discriminate against you on the basis of lifestyle factors or genetic test results. But life insurance companies currently can.
The ramifications go beyond genealogy tests. In November last year, ABC's 7:30 program showed a young father who, after undergoing genetic testing, found he had an increased risk of bowel and other cancers. When compelled to provide these results to an insurance company, he was refused life insurance for this cancer risk. A parliamentary inquiry into the life insurance industry found that people did not want to be part of trials that require genetic testing over potential damage to their insurability. I spoke to New South Wales Senator Deborah O'Neill, Deputy Chair of Corporations and Financial Services Committee, and asked her how insurance risks are affecting genetic research as a whole.
When I heard evidence from the representatives of the Australian Genetic and Non-Discrimination Working Group speak to us about changes in protocols that were emerging in the genetics research area, where ethics boards from universities had decided that one of the conditions that should be set before a research project could go ahead was for researchers to advise potential participants that they needed to take a financial advice before they participated in research, because participating in genetic research could compromise their insurance.
Following the 2016 case of a US man briefly becoming a suspect in a rape and murder investigation when his father's donated DNA was tested by police, there has been concern over law enforcement's access to stored genetic information, which genealogy services will hand over if there is a warrant or a subpoena. But Ms. Tiller says that at the moment, genealogy services DNA testing does not meet the standard to be admissible in Australian courts. But can you ask these services to remove your genetic information? Ms. Tiller again.
Most companies should remove your data if you ask for it. So if you ask them to delete or destroy your sample, they should do so. However, some people have reported having difficulty having that done. It's very difficult to track whether it's actually happened. And also, there's the actual DNA sample that you in the tube and you give it to somebody, but then there's all of the analysis of the data that's done, and some of that can't really be deleted completely. If it goes into a data set and it's not identified with your name anymore, it can be difficult for a company to pull that out, and so some companies don't do that.
Jane Tiller, Ethical, Legal and Social Advisor in Public Health Genomics at Monash University, ending that report by Caro Wagner.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
Yes, I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to The Wire around Australia. Well, Fairfax Media reported yesterday that China had begun preliminary talks with Vanuatu for a Chinese military build-up in that nation. This development has raised questions about Australia's standing in the region, and once again sparked debate about China's influence in our own backyard. Victor Petrovich has the story.
We should regard this as a potential game changer. It would have not only security but economic consequences for the region. And we should regard it as a wake-up call for Australia.
That is Shadow Foreign Minister Penny Wong speaking on the ABC about reports in the Fairfax media of China and Vanuatu conducting talks for an increased Chinese military presence in the nation. Vanuatu, like many nations in the Pacific, has traditionally looked to Australia as their closest ally. This move by China has forced Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to make clear this sentiment.
The maintenance of peace and stability in the Pacific is of utmost importance to us, to Australia. It's one of the key priorities of our foreign policy white paper. We would view with great concern the establishment of any foreign military bases in those Pacific Island countries.
Australia has been seen by many to be retreating in parts from major influence in the Pacific. This sentiment is echoed by Dr. Graeme Smith from the ANU Department of Pacific Affairs.
Look, I mean, it's very interesting in the case of Vanuatu, in that if you look at, say, for example, the Vanuatu Prime Minister, he's visited China twice. And is yet to make an official visit to Australia, which sends quite a, a significant signal. But that said, I think in terms of on the security side, we are, as Julie Bishop says, still Vanuatu's strategic partner of choice, because of the compatibility of our militaries, because of historical ties, and just because of the geography. We're a lot closer to Vanuatu than China is.
Shadow Minister for International Development Claire Moore has echoed the sentiment of her colleague Penny Wong, pointing to a declining spend on aid in the Pacific.
That Australia has withdrawn aid support, international development support, across our region over the last few years. And that creates a space where other nations who may well be able to move in and look at providing direct assistance will have a greater access to talking with all those countries across our region. So that's something that is concerning, and we have to be well aware of that.
This space that is left by countries like Australia is something that Graham Smith says that China targets.
Yeah, I mean, the soft power strategy is something that's taken very seriously at the highest levels of Chinese government now. Much like our own Department of Foreign Affairs, they now have official institutions that are to deal with soft power and to advance China's soft power.
Dr. Smith thinks that this soft power has the potential to reap real rewards for a superpower nation like China.
So what that really allows, the no free lunch scenario, allows you to put pressure on things such as recognising China's position in the South China Sea, which Vanuatu is the first Pacific nation to do so. You could use it in other ways in different international forums to get votes, to put pressure on Taiwan, to achieve any number of international goals that China has. But will they call that in all the time? I don't think that would be very sensible on their part, because after a while, the smaller countries will simply say, look, one, don't push us around, and two, yeah, you've made that threat before.
Senator Moore thinks that the government should be placing a higher priority on aid spending in the budget.
Since we lost government and the massive attacks on international development have been made, since that happened, we have been consistently talking about our concerns about the plummeting level of our investment and also what the impact of that would be. So this is not a new position we're taking. This is one that we've been talking about consistently as budget after budget. The current government has been looking at international development as a place for savings rather than future investment.
Dr. Smith believes that this spend still buys greater influence for Australia than what China has.
In perspective, they may have spent $2.3 billion, but it's still considerably less than the amount of aid that Australia would have spent in the region over that period, including Australia outspends China in Vanuatu, for example. What do they want as a quid pro quo? There's a famous quote, Dan McGarry from the Villa Post is on the record as saying he heard the Chinese ambassador in Vanuatu say there's no such thing as free lunch in reference to debts that Vanuatu held in the form of China Exim Bank loans.
One thing to keep in mind with these discussions, according to Senator Moore, is the demonising of foreign policy moves by nations like China.
One of the things I'm concerned about is the way the conversation's being had. It's being placed in a position of fear. So even the media this morning was raising alarm, causing fear. And that's not the best environment, and I talk about this all the time, the best environment to have the discussion. Should there be discussions between one of our countries, and this is Vanuatu, with China, that's something that will happen, can happen, and will happen. But in terms of using that as a press button fear media comment, I don't think takes into account the complexity of the situation.
Senator Claire Moore, Shadow Minister for International Development and the Pacific, ending that report by Victor Petrovich. Well, the disabled community has already faced disappointment in regards to accessibility at the Commonwealth Games in the Gold Coast. Despite assurance this wouldn't be the case, there have been reports of wheelchair users being sent to inaccessible parking spots on the night of the opening ceremony. Francesca Reed from 4EB in the Gold Coast reports.
Accessibility for disabled patrons of the Commonwealth Games has already fallen short at the first event. South Brisbane resident and tetraplegic Daniel Henschel was excited to be making his way to the opening ceremony of the Commonwealth Games. However, when he arrived at Yatala's Park and Ride facility to make his way to the stadium, Mr. Henschel discovered the accessible parking his wife had booked was not so accessible.
When I first drove in, I spoke to the people at the front desk and I asked them, is this what they call accessible?
The parking spot he was directed to was surfaced with gravel and dirt and located 15 metres away from the bus loading zone.
Able-bodied people, they may not see the difficulties with gravel. They may just think, oh, it's a flat surface, it's fine, but they don't understand that, you know, I have to push over that with my hands and that makes my hands all dirty and sore and it ruins the rest of the evening for me.
Gold medalist, Paralympian and Inclusions Moves founder Jeff Trappett was alerted to the situation on Wednesday night by Mr. Henschel.
Daniel has done exactly as has been asked of him regarding transport to Commonwealth Games. Told them that he uses a wheelchair for mobility, and he's been given a car park in what I would certainly call an inaccessible area.
As an advocate for the voice of the disabled community, Mr. Trappett was alarmed that disability access for the Games had fallen so short already.
The disability sector has had conversations with Department of Transport and Main Roads and the Goldock Organising Committee, where they had assured us that the car park facilities had been audited for accessibility, and the on-the-ground staff at venues will be allocating car parks to people as appropriate. It appears on this occasion that there certainly hasn't been an appropriate allocation of a car park to a wheelchair user.
Once the opening ceremony was over, Mr. Henschel said people filed out of the stadium, and as they made their way to the park and ride facility buses, able-bodied people were being divided into lines based on their destination. However, elderly and disabled passengers were directed down one path, the priority route, and Mr. Henschel says the problem with that is that everyone who was considered a priority passenger ended up pooled in one group at the end of one path.
Now, all different needs, we're all going to different spots. So we're all sitting around for quite a while, at least 40 minutes. There was a lot of confusion. A lot of people were saying, oh, I'm going to Yatala, I'm going to Millaroo. Where's that bus? Where's that bus? Nobody knew. A lot of people there with more needs than myself would become very uncomfortable. Almost as bad as gravel car park, if not worse.
Mr. Henschel expressed disappointment that the organisation of this event meant that people who required disability access were left to pick up the slack.
Consider varied needs and gain proper insight. The reason why people are 75% of the way there is they think they know what's needed. They go ahead and do it. They don't actually take opinions from people like myself or Jeff Trappett who truly know what's required.
Daniel Henschel ending that report from 4EB's Francesca Reid in the Gold Coast at the Commonwealth Games in Queensland. I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. Hello, if you're listening in Bowen, Queensland on Gem FM or Ultra 106.5 in Hobart. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au and you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite download app. Also on Facebook and Twitter, just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. Wire is a team effort by 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. You can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, broadcasting from Adelaide, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for your company.